The year 1931 brought a question that haunted every household. Would tomorrow be worse than today? Unemployment lines stretched around city blocks. Savings evaporated. Governments seemed paralyzed. Into this chaos stepped John Maynard Keynes with a collection of essays that dared to see beyond the rubble. These weren't just academic papers. They were economic prophecies written across 12 turbulent years. Some predictions proved eerily accurate. Others failed, not because they were wrong, but because people refused to listen. What makes these essays remarkable isn't just their intellectual brilliance, but their emotional urgency. Keynes wrote like someone watching a train wreck in slow motion, desperately trying to warn passengers still on board. His influence would eventually reshape how presidents, central bankers, and everyday citizens understand recessions, unemployment, and government intervention, though not before the world learned his lessons the hardest way possible. Paris, 1919. Victorious powers carved up Europe, drunk on revenge. Keynes, Britain's treasury representative, watched something terrible unfold. The Treaty of Versailles demanded Germany pay 132 billion gold marks in reparations. Like asking someone whose house just burned down to rebuild the entire neighborhood. Germany had lost its coal-rich territories, agricultural heartland, industrial regions, colonies, and foreign assets. What would it export to generate these payments? The answer was impossible. What bothered Keynes most was the willful blindness. Europe's economies were interconnected like a spider's web. German coal heated French homes. Austrian banks financed Italian trade. British loans sustained German industry. Destroying one thread meant unraveling the whole tapestry. Beyond economics lay something darker, condemning children for their ruler's sins. He predicted this humiliation would breed resentment and nationalism, prophecy fulfilled when hyperinflation devastated German savings and extremist politics filled the void. The treaty didn't end the war. It merely scheduled the sequel. Imagine a family where everyone owes everyone else money in impossible overlapping arrangements. Dad owes mom, who owes sister, who owes brother, who owes dad. And nobody can pay until someone else pays first. This was Europe after World War I. France and Italy owed Britain, Britain owed America, everyone was supposed to collect from Germany. Keynes saw the fundamental problem. Debtor nations do not love their creditors. The Balfour Note of 1925 created an especially perverse arrangement. Britain's receipts from Germany, plus Allied payments, must equal what Britain owed America. By 1928, Britain was paying America $33.2 million while receiving only $12.8 million from Allies. Keynes called for a general bonfire of debt, preferably orderly, but chaos if necessary. These government-to-government debts represented no real assets, no productive investments. They were paper chains binding everyone to mutual impoverishment, making recovery impossible and future conflict inevitable. "Lenin was certainly right," Keynes wrote provocatively. "There is no subtler, no surer means of overturning the existing basis of society than to debauch the currency. Through continuous inflation, governments secretly confiscate wealth in ways so complex that not one man in a million could diagnose the theft. For a century, the investment system rested on one assumption: money would hold its value. Middle-class families bought government bonds as gilt-edged securities, safe as crown jewels. War shattered this illusion. The middle class lost half their real wealth in England, 7/8 in France, 11/12 in Italy, and virtually everything in Germany, Austria-Hungary, and Russia. During inflation, business becomes dangerously easy. Borrow money, watch inventory appreciate, repay with cheaper currency. Instant profit. But this depreciation-driven gain carries moral poison. The businessman transforms from society's builder into the profiteer, half guilty and fully resented. When gains come from monetary manipulation rather than productive effort, the system's legitimacy crumbles." Gold's supremacy as money rested on tradition, not logic. Throughout history, silver often dominated. Gold's reign was barely 50 years old when war disrupted it. All gold mined in 7,000 years could fit on a single modern ship. This scarcity cloaked itself in respectability, becoming part of conservative apparatus resistant to questioning. Keynes's generation witnessed a fatal change. Gold withdrew from circulation into central bank vaults, becoming abstract, merely numbers transferred between institutions. Churchill's 1925 decision to return Britain to the gold standard at pre-war parity was catastrophic. The policy demanded British export industries reduce prices by 10% to remain competitive, essentially a 2 shilling pay cut per pound earned for everyone. Without machinery for simultaneous reduction across the economy, the policy forced a brutal struggle where the weakest would be beaten down first. Churchill erred through poor judgment, conventional financial pressure, and experts who miscalculated the maladjustment. The obsession with restoring pre-war values ignored a crucial reality. Society had adjusted to new price levels. Restoring old values through deflation would raise rentier claims to an intolerable proportion of national income. Britain sacrificed its industrial competitiveness and workers' livelihoods on the altar of monetary orthodoxy, a golden idol that demanded real human sacrifice. By 1930, 10 million workers sat idle across America, Britain, and Germany. Unlike 1921's post-war collapse, this devastation emerged from normal conditions. Keynes mapped the chain reactions. Farmers and miners lost purchasing power and couldn't buy manufactured goods. Factories reduced output and laid off workers. Unemployed workers couldn't buy agricultural products. Each group's rational response, cutting production, reducing wages, hoarding cash, made collective conditions worse. The debt overhang compounded the crisis. A farmer who borrowed when wheat was $2 per bushel now needed twice as many bushels to repay when prices halved. Society's productive capacity remained intact. Factories stood ready, workers were willing, goods were needed, but the monetary mechanism had seized up. Keynes traced the breakdown to insufficient new investment. Most counterintuitively, increased saving during slumps worsened conditions. Whenever you save 5 shillings, you put a man out of work for a day. The solution required expansion, buying things, making things, doing things, patriotic consumption, not penny pinching. Keynes envisioned humanity solving its oldest problem, economic scarcity. Until 1700, living standards stagnated for millennia. Then technical innovation revolutionized everything. The power of compound interest was staggering. If Sir Francis Drake's Spanish treasure had been invested at compound interest in 1580, it would have matched England's entire foreign investments by Keynes's time. With continued progress, living standards could rise 4 to 8 times higher within a century. But what then? Keynes critiqued purposiveness, our tendency to value future results over present experience. The purposive person is always trying to secure a spurious and delusive immortality, never enjoying now. Jam is not jam unless it is a case of jam tomorrow and never jam today. In the future, Keynes envisioned returning to traditional virtue, recognizing avarice as vice and honoring those who toil not. Yet pragmatically, for at least another century, we must maintain that foul is useful and fair is not. Only avarice could lead us from economic necessity. Economics should eventually become a humble specialty like dentistry. Keynes's vision remains provocative. Economic growth should serve human flourishing, not become an end itself.